Hey everyone, I'm your host Patrick Brown. Welcome to Crown and Crozier. In the fall of 2021, an announcement involving a certain bishop of the Church of England made international headlines. It was revealed that Bishop Michael Nazir Ali of the Diocese of Rochester, among the most senior and high-profile leaders within the Anglican Church, had converted to Catholicism. In this episode, we sit down with Monsignor Nazir Ali as he reflects on his first year of membership in that mystical body of Christ, also known as the Catholic Church. We explore moments from his life which served as major waypoints in his journey of faith, including his embrace of Christianity during his youth in Pakistan, his hasty departure from his homeland after crossing swords with militant Islamist authorities, and his ultimate conclusion that both the deposit of faith and its authentic ministry dwelled most fully within Catholicism. We also discuss pivotal issues in the contemporary life of the Church, including the need for sacred tradition and magisterial authority to guide the transmission of the faith, especially in any exercise such as the Synod on Synodality. To top it all off, we touch on St. John Henry Newman, the death of Queen Elizabeth II, and the legacy of the early Church as a persecuted minority which ended up changing the course of human history. Don't forget to subscribe to the show or leave us a rating. Hope you enjoy this installation of the podcast on Church, State, and Faithful Citizenship.
There are two swords, and the question is, which sword is superior, the spiritual sword or the temporal sword?
And without God, democracy will not and cannot long endure.
I die His Majesty's good servant, at God's first.
Father Michael Nazir Ali, welcome to Crown and Crozier.
Thank you. It's very good to speak to you.
There's so many places, so many things I'd like to cover with you. It's such an honor to have you on the show. I think where I'd like to start, and for the benefit of our listeners as well, getting to know you a little better. You grew up as a Christian in Pakistan. Tell us more about that.
Yes, my father comes from a Muslim background, but he became a Christian. But I came really to a personal faith when I was at university there. So all of us have to make that kind of decision, haven't we, about what faith we are to confess and follow. So in our day, I mean, there were really three choices. There was already radical Islam was making its claims. And there was Marxism. People have forgotten that perhaps a little bit, but for young people that was very attractive in those days. And then there was the Christian faith. So I was greatly helped by a man who was a chaplain in the university. Religious leaders were actually banned from our university. That was nothing to do with being anti-Christian. It was even then to prevent extremism on the campus. But he got in by registering as a postgraduate student, so there's always a way. It was by his example that I got interested in mission and also in ministry and to train for ministry and to be ordained into the Anglican Church and to minister there as a priest and a bishop for many years.
Well, among other things, a journey of conversion is always extraordinary in and of itself, but the backdrop, the social and cultural backdrop, Christians were and are remain a minority in Pakistan. So can you speak a little bit more, and not to put too fine a point on it, but Pakistan is often cited as one of the most challenging climates for a Christian to live and to practice their faith. We've done previous episodes on this show talking about the persecution and the violence that Christians face. So not only did you convert to the faith, but you did it against a backdrop of persecution, fear, and violence. How did that affect your journey?
Well, in my lifetime, that has become worse, much worse than it used to be. When Pakistan was founded, the Christians actually supported its creation, because they felt that those who'd been a minority in undivided India, that is to say the Muslims, would treat other minorities well. And certainly the founders of the country, that was their intention, but that has not been the case since. And persecution, discrimination, exclusion has grown, and the emergence of the blasphemy laws have been particularly a dead hand on freedom of speech and even of worship. And as you were saying, there's been both judicial persecution and extrajudicial persecution in the form of mobs setting fire to churches, to Christian villages, and attacking people and sometimes killing them. So, yeah, the situation has grown more and more challenging, I think I have to say.
And may I ask, has that affected, or did that affect you personally or members of your family, or how has this touched you?
Oh, yes, it affected me personally. That was one reason. I mean, I was a bishop in Pakistan, and one of the reasons for my leaving had to do with this kind of pressure, which came from the government of the time, which was an Islamist government, and also from other sections of society. So, of course, opinion in Pakistan in these matters is divided. So there are many people who, many Muslims, who still have goodwill for Christians and Christian institutions, but there are others who don't. And that's where the difficulty arises.
So what first prompted you to make the move from Pakistan to the United Kingdom? You were an Anglican priest or an Anglican bishop at the time. What was the story there?
Yes, I got into difficulty with the then government because they asked us our opinion about the enforcing of Sharia penal law in Pakistan. And I got to write the paper for the Council of Churches about this, where I had to say, relying in this matter on C.S. Lewis, as a matter of fact, that a Christian view of punishment included retribution for a crime, but it must also include the possibility of reform and of rehabilitating the person. So we could not endorse, therefore, punishments that mutilated the body in any way, for instance, injured the person physically or mentally, and of course could not support execution, which was also prescribed in a number of cases. Alongside that, I was working with many other people, with the women who had organized themselves, mainly Muslim women, to prevent the limitation of their own freedoms in education and employment. And that didn't go down very well either. I was at that time working with bonded labor. People didn't mind as long as we were just taking services and so on with them. But when we began to ask why they were bonded and to show a way out of their situation in terms of education or housing or alternative employment, then all hell broke loose. And so those were the immediate reasons. I came to visit, routine visit to the Archbishop of Canterbury at the time, Robert Runcie, who said that his reading was that the situation was quite serious and that I should come out of it for a while. And he had a job for me, which was at that time to do some of the organization for an approaching Lambeth conference. This was of 1988. And so that's how it happened, yeah.
So may I ask, I can't help but observe the stark contrast. You go essentially fleeing, a hasty departure from your homeland on account of your faith. You are a persecuted minority. And then you go to a country that has an establishment church. And
yes,
you're part of that establishment.
Yes.
I'm just curious if you can comment on that. I mean, what the transition was like and how that struck you in terms of going from a place very low down the ladder to being part of the establishment in an establishmentarian country.
Of course, I'd been familiar with it before because I had studied and taught a little in the United Kingdom before. establishment has many different aspects to it, so it's not all privilege. I mean, in fact, in the Church of England, it can probably be said now that establishment tends to have more responsibility than privilege. But I have in the past argued for establishment on the basis that if the state wanted to hear the voice of the church in its councils, why should the church decline? But this has to do also with not compromising. So the church's presence and voice must be without compromise. And I'm reminded very often of St. John Fisher, who was, of course, also Bishop of Rochester. When Henry VIII was pressing the convocations of the clergy to accept the royal supremacy, Fisher himself and eventually the convocations encouraged him to accept that they could acknowledge the royal supremacy, but only insofar as the law of Christ allows. I found that rider very useful in all sorts of ways, not just about establishment, but to say, yes, we can accept government legislation in education, for instance, or in the social sphere, but only insofar as the law of Christ allows. I also feel that that the question about the Judeo-Christian tradition as animating social and other kinds of policy and legislation in the United Kingdom is more important than the establishing of any church. So even if there was no established church, the Judeo-Christian tradition would still be important for discussion about policy and legislation as a point of departure on things like the nature and dignity of the human person, on what is the meaning of equality or of liberty in terms of conflict, the just war tradition, for example, and its limitations on engaging in armed conflict. I mean, all of those things, you have to begin somewhere. And the Judeo-Christian tradition is the place from where to begin in this country.
For my bearings and clarification, you arrived in the United Kingdom. When were you appointed Bishop of Rochester?
1994.
That was a see that you held until your conversion to the Catholic faith. Some 20 years
no,
later?
No, I held the see. I resigned the see in 2009 because I was being asked by leaders in different parts of Christian leaders of all denominations in different parts of the world where there is persecution of Christians to help them to develop leadership. So that is when we set up this small charity, Oxtrad, to help develop leadership in the persecuted churches, which we do in many different ways in terms of formal education or education by extension or research facilities. And indeed, I supervise some research students. One has just left who are working either in the persecuted churches or for them in a whole number of areas.
So appointed Bishop of Rochester in 1994, one of the more high-profile, one of the more well-known sees within the Anglican Church.
Yeah, it's the second oldest see in England, yeah, after Canterbury, founded in 604. So we celebrated our 1400th anniversary, and part of that was a visit to Pope John Paul II, because, of course, it was Pope Gregory the Great who had sent the early missionaries to the Anglo-Saxons, and particularly to Kent, where both Canterbury and Rochester are located.
So when did the little voice on your shoulder, speaking about the Catholic faith, start to make itself known? How did your journey, how did your openness, your flirtation with Catholicism, when and how were those seeds planted, and where did they take you over time?
I don't think it's a flirtation. It's always been a serious affair, if you want to use that sort of language. Yeah, I was a member of the Anglican Roman Catholic International Commission for a very long time. And as you know, the commission had been set up by Pope Paul VI and Archbishop Michael Ramsay of Canterbury explicitly to remove the obstacles to full communion between the two traditions. So we worked, my predecessors and those contemporary with me worked very hard at removing those obstacles on the doctrine of the Eucharist, on ministry in the church, on authority, on the Blessed Virgin Mary, on making moral decisions, and so on. But some of us began to be frustrated when the Anglican Communion, in spite of these agreements and having received these agreements, then acted unilaterally, as it were, without reference to the Catholic Church as a partner to those agreements. So on the question of the ordination of women to the priesthood and later on to the episcopate, I knew that three successive popes had pleaded with the Anglican Communion not to ordain women to the presbyterate and later to the episcopate unilaterally, because they said, you know, the question was not whether women should or should not be ordained, but how those decisions should be made, that if the Anglican Communion was serious about forging greater unity with the Catholic Church, then they could not act unilaterally in a matter of church order of this gravity. But the reply that they were given, the popes were given, and the representatives were given was, well, even if we wanted to prevent this, we could not, because every province in the Anglican Communion is autonomous and can, in the end, do whatever it likes. Now, whether that was strictly true in terms of Anglican background itself is a matter that can be discussed, but that was said, and that is what happened. This then extended, of course, also to things like same-sex relationships and the ordination of people in those relationships, and particularly the ordination of a bishop who was in such a relationship. So the archic process nearly broke down on those matters. What that alerted me to was how decisions are made, and I could see that Anglicanism had no way of making decisions that applied universally and could be made to stick universally, to be implemented universally. And that is still the case. I mean, in fact, if anything, it's become worse. Secondly, that whatever common teaching that there was on these matters was now being widely rejected. So there was no common basis for the faithful to assess developments. And then thirdly, of course, there was no magisterium. There was no ultimate authority, which in the end, after all the discussion had taken place and all the scholarship, could say, this is the way to go and not that. I think those were the sorts of main reasons. I mean, those were the reasons why I felt that the Catholic Church was the only church that provided these bases for decision-making in the church. As I've said, what I've said so far has been negative about the Anglican tradition. But at the same time, I felt there were many positive things about Anglicanism that I did not want to be seen to be rejecting. So that is why I joined the Ordinariate, which Pope Benedict very wisely and with great foresight had provided for those Anglicans who wanted to be in full communion with the Catholic Church. And I want those positive things, as Pope Paul VI had said, nothing of the legitimate patrimony of the Anglican Communion would be lost in coming into full communion with the Catholic Church. And that remains my desire, and it, at least partially, it sees some fulfillment in the Ordinariates.
If you don't mind me asking, the factors to which you just referred, and you can disagree with my assessment here, it seems that they fall under the categories of ecclesiology and doctrine, how the church is structured, how it should function, what it professes as a matter of doctrine. And one could say that perhaps those are matters of the head. To what extent did your conversion involve matters of the heart?
Head and heart should, of course, go together, because, of course, that has been the weakness of pietistic Protestantism, is to separate the two. Yeah, I mean, for example, on the sacraments, I think that the Reformation has been simply wrong about the sacraments and their nature and their number and how they assist Christian believers in their devotion and in living their Christian life. So in my First Things article, I set out why that was so. But I think the richness of the Catholic Church in its understanding of the sacraments and how believers are supported in their life of faith through the sacraments is also a very important reason. I think not the reformers perhaps so much, but their successors were wrong about the role of the Blessed Virgin Mary, for instance, not doing full justice to what the scriptures themselves say about her, but also her role in the church throughout the ages. So those also were factors. I think the evangelical wing of Anglicanism is becoming more and more nonconformist-like. So doing away with reverence and posture and liturgy in worship, I think that is impoverishing. On the other hand, the high church tradition, the sort of so-called Anglo-Catholic tradition, the danger is that you keep the form without the content. Yeah, I think Catholicism is avoiding and must continue to avoid those twin dangers.
You converted in late 2021, is that correct?
Yes, that is correct, yeah.
So we've just passed the one-year anniversary of your entry into the Catholic Church. When your conversion came to light publicly, it made international headlines. I mean, certainly it was news in the United Kingdom, but on this side of the pond, in the Atlantic, certainly within Catholic media, but I mean, I came across the occasional headline in mainstream media drawing attention to this high-profile member of the Anglican episcopate who converted. Did the nature of the public reaction, did that surprise you, and how did you react?
No, it didn't surprise me. I made provision. I knew this would happen. And in fact, I had warned people concerned that it would happen. We were slightly wrong-footed by the fact that the news was leaked before it was due to be released by the Catholic Bishops' Conference. But it was leaked only a few days earlier. But it did mean that for several days I had to put aside other things just to deal with the media, the mainstream media. I mean, the church media came later, and it's still going on, of course. I think most of the coverage has been sympathetic. There's been some hostility, but I accept that and expected it. So sometimes from quarters that were surprising. But there we are. I mean, that's life.
There were reports at the time that within certain corners of the Catholic Church hierarchy, including in the Vatican, your conversion induced some discomfort. And there was this sense of some people in the Vatican didn't quite know how to deal with it, or they even almost seemed inconvenienced by it. I don't want to put you in an uncomfortable position, but was that true? And what was your impression of that?
No, I have no such knowledge whatsoever. And in fact, Pope Francis, only a few months after my ordination, made me a prelate of honor to him. That was very kind of him, undeserving, but kind of him. And I've been invited to teach at Catholic universities in Rome and elsewhere, and have done so, and to meet bishops in conference, like the Asian bishops I've recently been with. So, and I visited Vatican dicasteries, and that kind of thing has not been expressed to me anyway.
That's encouraging to hear that the welcome has been warm. It's been one year since your conversion. Looking back on your first year, what are your reflections?
Well, obviously, I've been asked to speak on different topics by Catholic groups, by dioceses, and even, as I say, a continental conference like the Asian bishops. and universities and so on. Even tonight, I'm speaking to the Catholic Society here at the University of Oxford. So that's a great privilege. I've not settled into a sort of pastoral base for all sorts of reasons having to do with my diary to some extent, which has to be honored, but I intend to do that, and I think that is quite important to do. I've done some writing in this area, but also in other areas. I have lecturing responsibilities, so I have to prepare for those. Generally, nothing that I did not expect.
Perhaps you had the advantage, given your years of participating in a formal structure of dialogue with the Catholic Church, to have gotten to know and to have seen up front the warts and the blemishes and the dirty laundry in the Catholic Church. It's no secret that the Catholic Church is, Christ is our head, we're divinely instituted, but we have human members, and therefore there is a high degree of imperfection in and across the Church. How has that factored into your decision to convert and now in your first year, getting to know more deeply and upfront the fact that the Church and Catholics are not perfect, we come with some baggage, but yet you still decided to join the family?
Yeah, if you find a perfect church, don't join it, lest you spoil it, is the sort of watchword. I mean, there is no perfect church in that sense, and church is a company of sinners, but who are also saints in the making. I mean, all of those things I fully accept. However, we have to be prudent in what we do, and we need to make sure that the transmission of the apostolic teaching, which makes the church, is observed and passed on faithfully. Of course, in different cultures at different times, people notice different things in the apostolic teaching that other people may not have noticed or emphasized. I mean, that's a matter for discussion. But faithfulness to the transmission of the tradition is very important. There is new knowledge. Not every claim to new knowledge is authentic, but some of it is. And St. John Henry Newman has shown us how to deal with that, with his development of doctrine, and how the Catholic Church actually engages with the new, and that has to be in a principled way, in the terms that he set out. Pope John Paul II, who so emphasized the value of enculturation, not only among the Slav people, but generally in cultures throughout the world today, but he also said there were limits to enculturation. It should not compromise the very nature of the gospel, and it should not jeopardize communion, fellowship among Christians from different cultures, and of course churches from different cultures. So the Catholic Church has been fortunate, I was going to say, but it's been providential that it has held together both the sacred deposit of faith and the sacred ministry, which serves that deposit of faith. It is not its master, but its servant. And we should make sure that that relationship, that alignment remains healthy. From the very beginning, from New Testament times, in fact, if you think of the Council of Jerusalem, those who have responsibility for deciding and for teaching have always consulted others of the faithful, and that's fine. But when people meet together, I mean, the characteristic way of Catholics, Christians meeting together is to pray together, and specifically to celebrate the Eucharist together. That also is part of how the church is made. And again, the ministry of the church has a role to play in that, in making Christ present to his people in the Eucharist. There has to be a making of decisions from time to time, and there also has to be the exercise of discipline. And where there has been exclusion of anyone for any reason throughout the history of the church, that has always been for the purpose of restoration of that person. So Yeah, all of those things are right. Walking together, I mean, that is what synod means, to walk together. I mean, it's a good thing. But in this walking together, different people have different roles. So not everyone has the same role. In consulting the faithful, we must make sure, it is the church's responsibility to make sure that the faithful are adequately catechized. And the responsibilities that the bishops have, for example, for teaching in union with the Bishop of Rome, that responsibility cannot be set aside. The Bishop of Rome has a solemn duty to declare, confirm, if necessary, correct the faith of the church from time to time. And no one, neither the bishops nor anyone, can change the faith of the church, of course. But they do have a duty to declare and to confirm it from time to time as need arises. So I call this differentiated conciliarity or differentiated synodality, where different parts of the church have different responsibilities in the church and in the process of walking together in the way of Christ.
We talked about what it was like growing up in Pakistan as a Christian, as a religious minority. You then went to the United Kingdom and you were part of the establishment church in an establishmentarian country. Since your conversion to Catholicism, you're now back in the minority. I'd just like to hear your thoughts on what it's like being, what it's like to have been a member of a faith in a minority in two different countries, in two very different contexts, and the extent to which that may have strengthened you, and the extent to which we need to remind ourselves of the lesson that sometimes strength in the faith is a fruit of being in the minority or even being persecuted. I mean, our Lord himself told us that blessed are those who are persecuted in my name. Can you reflect on that a little bit for us?
Well, I mean, I think in either of those contexts, and indeed in any context, the main thing is to be faithful, whatever the cost of that may be. Now, I'm not one for making sudden decisions, as you've probably gathered by now. But once we know what is the truth, we then have to follow it. Minorities, you know, change the world. I mean, look at the Jesus movement at the very beginning. They were a minority, they were persecuted, they were martyred. They still changed the world. And so can we, because, in fact, there is no other worldview, there is no other narrative that can hold the ground in the face of the claims of the Catholic faith. And what we need is to give our people the confidence to know that and to say that. I mean, talking to the Asian bishops recently, many of them are in very minority situations. One of the things that they kept saying was that although they are tiny minorities in some of those countries, they exercise an influence out of all proportion to their numbers for the good, for the common good, for the good of society. And I think that should be the case with Catholics in the United Kingdom. They're not as small a minority as they may think, or as others might think. In terms of attendance and so forth, they are now probably the largest Christian group. They have many important institutions, not least the schools, which are so important now for bringing up children to know what are right relationships, what their destiny is, personal as well as what social destiny might mean, how to be stewards in God's world. I mean, all of those things that every young person is asking, and our schools have the responsibility to make sure that the questions that young people ask are adequately answered in terms of the Catholic faith.
Just with our remaining time, I want to touch on another current events issue, if you will. Back in July of this year, so a few months ago, you wrote a column in the Catholic Herald, and this was at a time when the Conservative Party in the United Kingdom was undertaking yet another leadership contest. But you wrote a column in the summer of this year, essentially saying, in the context of this open Conservative Party leadership contest, that the leadership campaign, and any leadership campaign of this nature for a major party, it serves as an opportunity and as a reminder that respect for God and respect for man should serve as the basis for public moral renewal. Among other things, I was very taken with that. Here in Canada, there was also a leadership contest in the Federal Conservative Party taking place at the same time. So it had a lot of resonance for me as well. But respect for God and respect for man serving as the basis for public moral renewal. You wrote that just a few months before Queen Elizabeth II passed away. I couldn't help but think that her funeral, the rituals, the rites, her funeral seemed to me to be an amazing opportunity for a renewal of public morality. The distinctly Christian flavor of that ritual, of that service, I think took a lot of people's breath away. It was a reminder of the Christian character and the Christian heritage of the United Kingdom. If you could just speak to that a little bit more, what the occasion of Queen Elizabeth's death meant and what it could potentially serve as reinforcing this renewal of public morality in your country.
Yes, she had, of course, a very deeply personal faith, and quite a lot of what happened she had already arranged for. So it didn't just happen. I mean, there was an intention behind it. And yes, I mean, you know, 4 billion people are supposed to have watched the funeral. It was a great occasion for Christian witness, and I'm very glad that that witness was given. But in this country, because of its long history, it is quite possible to preserve form, whether it is in politics or in faith or in society, without necessarily preserving also the content. This we may see again at the coronation of the new king. The coronation service is the most ancient piece of public ritual that there is in this country. And we will see that again. And of course, it has very deep Christian roots. And again, we will see that. But the question arises to what extent the people who are engaging in it believe it. And how far do they believe it? I mean, what implications does that have for their belief? Those are questions that cannot just be answered very quickly. We see this in the whole business of constitutional monarchy itself, that ministers can put the monarch in a situation, because the monarch can only act on their advice, which may compromise Christian teaching, for instance. And what do they do then? I mean, I don't envy at all the role of the monarch in a constitutional monarchy. So, yeah, the answer is not a simple one, I'm afraid. It's very good that the funeral was such a positive Christian witness, and we thank God for Her Majesty who made sure that it was. But that does not necessarily mean that those who saw the form will also appropriate for themselves, that's the key issue, isn't it, the content of the form.
I'm just going to sneak in one final question here. I'm sure some of our listeners can't resist the question, but what was the nature of your relationship with the Queen? Did you know her? How was she involved in your appointment? And with her relatively recent passing, I mean, how do you reflect on her life and any interaction you may have had with her?
Yes, I've had a lot of interaction. I mean, not all of it I can talk about publicly. But one thing I will say is that preaching to her in her presence was a delight, because she was always entirely attentive to the word of God being preached. I think that's a lot to say, and I pray that her successors will continue to be as attentive.
I think that's a great place to wrap up our conversation. Father Michael Nazir Ali, thank you so much for sharing insights from your very rich and storied life. We wish you the best in this second year of membership in the Universal Church. We're very grateful for your time here today. Thank you so much.
Thank you. God bless you.
Thanks for tuning in. If you like what you heard, don't forget to subscribe to our show wherever you get your podcasts, and help us to reach more listeners by leaving us a rating or referring us to a friend. If you'd like to partner with us in the delivery of this podcast, head on over to our website at crownandcrozier.com and click the heart button in the top right-hand corner to learn more about making a one-time or monthly donation. We're sincerely grateful for you listening in, and we look forward to providing you with future episodes on church, state, and faithful citizenship. Until then, God bless.